Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The coronavirus pandemic continues to surge, and fatalities in the United States have topped 157,000, and 1 million additional Americans submitted new unemployment claims, bringing the total out of work to, again, well north of 30 million. Meanwhile, lawmakers in Washington, D.C. remain divided about a fourth stimulus package as the NDAA and appropriations process grind along. Joining us to discuss the week in Washington are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Vago.
Thank you.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Michael, as you have started us off in many, 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 many weeks in a row, bring us up to speed on any order you want to take this. On NDAA appropriations, the fourth stimulus package, and even talk and rumors of the possibility of another continuing resolution. So start us off wherever you think it makes sense to start that off.
Okay, great. Thank you. So this week I get to talk about all the things that are not happening. So the enthusiasm.
Which is not funny, actually. I'm sorry for laughing.
So it's unfortunately the new normal. So, you know, hopes for a very quick NDAA conference have quickly faded. I've talked to leaders on both the House and the Senate, and they think the NDAA conference will obviously begin this month, but will not be finished until probably after the election. A lot of staff are heading out of town right now, and there's really no sense of urgency to get it completed quickly. Senate, as far as appropriations, are nowhere. Again, the earliest they would get their appropriations done is September, October. At this point, probably later. But all of a sudden, there's been a talk and serious talk of a continuing resolution being passed, not in September when Congress is back, but next week. At first, a lot of these rumors were discounted even by a lot of the appropriators. But about 10 minutes before the call, one of the senior appropriators texted me saying, it is very possible that a CR is passed next week. And if they do that, the CR would most likely go into November, probably Thanksgiving, if not later, would mean that Congress may not come back at all if there's no until after the election, if there's nothing else to vote on, especially if there's no stimulus package to vote on, right. Which leads us to the discussion of where we are on that package. So there have been no major breakthroughs since the last time we did the podcast, or this week. It's moving at a very slow pace. In fact, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said the other day, we're a long way from striking any deal. Problem is, they set a deadline for themselves of tomorrow. And even today, there's no sense of urgency because the two sides are not meeting again until 5 o'clock today. This all at the same time where it looks like 30 million Americans are currently at the risk of eviction, tens of millions of Americans at the risk of being food insecure. So you know, where does that really leave us with really no sense of urgency? Now, there's lots of differences between the two, but the big ones that are being talked about this week are, you know, the enhanced unemployment. You know, the Democrats still want $600 in weekly enhanced benefits. Republicans offered a one-week extension. Now they're saying they would offer $400 weekly through September. State aid continues to be a huge sticking point between the two. The Republicans offered no funding for state aid in their bill. The White House continues to say it's a bailout for poorly managed states. But now the administration is offering $150 billion for states, but they want things like school funding, which costs about $105 billion, to be included under that category. And the Democrats are rejecting any kind of accounting method like that. And now the Postal Service is rising again as an issue, which could be a whole separate topic of discussion. But the Democrats wanted $25 billion to help the Postal Service over 3 years. And now they've cut back to saying they just want $10 billion, but the Republicans continue to reject that. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why they're really struggling to get things moving. I mean, one we talked about last week is there still is a divide within the Republican Party as to what they want to do and arguing over not only what should be in it, but how much it's going to cost. The timing really became an issue. I mean, the Democrats passed their bill, the HEROES Act, over 2 months ago. And the Republicans really waited till July to get us a lay of the land, knowing that eviction moratorium and extended unemployment benefits were going to expire at the end of the month. So they really put themselves up against the wall. Not only are there policy differences, but there's a huge difference on the price tag. I mean, Pelosi said earlier this week that she would settle for $3.4 trillion, where the Republicans are offering a trillion, and most of their folks think that's too high. We're less than 100 days out to election. As you know, the closer we get to election day, the harder it is for the two sides to come together. And there's the other variable that we talked about several weeks ago, that previous packages have been negotiated on behalf of the administration by Mnuchin, but now Mark Meadows is in the mix. So it's Meadows and Mnuchin. And there are even some Republicans that feel that it's Meadows' job to blow this whole thing up. So you see the Democrats saying they don't want a short-term extension. So what Meadows is offering is to the president is, why doesn't the president on his own go out and execute three executive orders? And they're looking at three executive actions, one which would delay the collection of federal payroll taxes, which, you know, the president has been pushing for a long time. Two would reinstate the expired eviction moratorium. And three would extend enhanced federal unemployment benefits using unspent money already appropriated by Congress. They've already, the White House has already asked federal agencies to identify money that has not yet been spent from the CARES Act. And these officials are trying to determine whether this money could be redirected and used for other purposes, such as temporary unemployment benefits and the eviction moratorium. So if a deal is not struck soon, my personal take is that this is where they're headed. I think this is their intention of where to go. And I actually believe that they'll announce these executive orders the same day that Biden announces his vice president next week, just to keep the focus on Trump.
I mean, there's so much of this that's so problematic, right? So the president continues to target Social Security, which is a third rail, at the same time targeting the postal system, which, by the way, is easy to solve if you didn't have an idiotic, legally mandated handicap to the postal system to pay its, you know, pension liabilities decades into the future, which no organization in the United States, I mean, the federal government doesn't even do it that way, which is absurd, right? I mean, at the end of the, and then there's a concern that Republicans are shooting themselves in the head at a time when we're in the worst, you know, economic and medical crisis in more than a century. So, I mean, how much authority does the president have to execute any of this?
It's a great question, and they're still trying to figure it out themselves. But, you know, as far as they're concerned, they don't care whether they have the authority. They tend out move out on things anyway. I mean, you see the president's even talking about doing his acceptance speech at the convention on the White House lawn, which is probably a violation of the Hatch Act, and most Republicans are coming out saying it's a very bad idea. But, you know, there is a lot of risk here for the Democrats, you know, holding their ground, because if they will not agree to a short-term extension to alleviate these problems, it really does give the president an opening to come in saying, I'm going to save the day with my three executive orders. So there's just a lot of question marks.
Dove or Gordon, does the president have the authority to do this? And how do you guys, or McKenzie, right? I mean, does the president have the authority to use monies like this going back to Congress at the end of the day?
He doesn't care. I mean, remember, he took money from the Defense Department to build the wall, military construction money. And Congress was very upset because that's not how it's been done before. He doesn't care. He'll go ahead and do it and do what he always told all his contractors when he was in private business. If you don't like it, sue me. In this case, he'll say, if you don't like it, take it to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, he's going to go ahead. The fact that he's brought in Mark Meadows, and Mike pointed this out, is really critical here. Look who the player is. It's not McConnell. It's Meadows. And Meadows is probably among the most unreconstructed former members of the House who, you know, Freedom Caucus and all that. He likes to blow things up. And in this case, it works for the president. I think this is the only way they can box Pelosi in, because Pelosi has a very strong Democratic caucus behind her and works very well with Schumer on this. This is the way they end run the system. And so I agree. I think he's going to go with those executive orders. It'll put him in a better light, perhaps, but it certainly will play into the hands of his base, which, again, really likes blowing up the government. So I think that's where he's going.
Gordon?
I'm tempted to say that there's an election going on, by the way. There's an election going on, by the way. Or maybe there's an election going on, by the way. In other words, everything that is being considered to be done is not really, I think, largely focused on how you define the needs or the intensity or the immediacy of the need, as it is with how is this going to play in the elections. And that's, I think, where the White House is coming from. I think it's probably right. There will be executive orders that attempt to do this. And I think it is, as Dove says, it's largely within his purview to do it and let somebody else take him to the Supreme Court to suffer the consequences. All he has to do is say, I've got a national emergency here. This is something we have to deal with. This is something we're going to do. And then untangling the shoelaces on that one is going to take a year or two, and he may not even be there. So I think the electoral temptation here is very high, that this is what they will try to do, because it will be, they will see it. And right now, we're looking at a White House that is running behind in election terms. The polling has the president slipping in key states, in those major states that turned the election for Trump in 2016. They are clearly desperate to find ways to hang things around the Democrats' neck, around Joe Biden's neck. They are clearly looking for ways to demonstrate competence in a performance around both the economy and COVID that seems to demonstrate to many incompetence. So reach for anything that's in the toolkit behind you and throw it at the election. That's what's going to drive this.
And look, a lot of this is, as Iron Mike told us, sort of fundamental divisions within the Republican caucus that is causing this. I mean, I think that New York Times had a terrific story on McConnell sort of being like, well, you know, let's wait and see where this is going, as opposed to he just doesn't have the votes in his own caucus for this, even in the best of terms. Mackenzie, what's your sense and some key takeaways from how you're looking at all of this?
So I'm going to take it down to an aerospace and defense level, but bringing in a key theme that all of the roundtable has raised, which is there is unity on the Democratic Party side, and it's bicameral. And you see this reflected in an op-ed today by Senator Durbin and HASC Chairman Adam Smith, of course, Chairman of Armed Services, and then Senator Durbin is the lead Democratic minority appropriator in the Senate. So that's a pretty interesting op-ed pairing. And what they basically said today is, you know, hold that, slow it down, Pentagon, on your request for relief funds from stimulus spending. And so they walked through a couple of their issues. And it's interesting because it's not over, per se. The $8 billion we talked about last week, which was seemingly kind of tone deaf and tin-eared, you know, a lot of weapons and other programs from the priorities list. But they're talking about CARES Act funding. And what the two members are essentially saying was, you know, we appropriated $10.5 billion in the CARES Act for defense industrial base needs. We too care about the industrial base, but they admit what most of us already knew. But we really kind of expected you to take it out of Hyde. So, because other federal agencies are do that. And you have so much money, it's raining money over there at DOD. And so what's the issue? So they're talking about this fourth stimulus potential. They reference unofficial requests from the Pentagon for $11 billion in emergency funds to cover costs for just this year. And they say it's for two purposes. And they say that there's a lack of detail in there, and that's causing them concern. The two purposes are to pay contractors for the time that they couldn't or you know, wouldn't go to work out of fear. And then, of course, to what extent the pandemic and its economic consequences are going to make it more expensive to do research and development and execute, you know, basically major defense programs going forward. So they accuse the Pentagon of not doing its homework and basically says it might make sense to appropriate some things here and there, but it, in other cases, it might not. So whatever the Pentagon's expectations were, if there even is that stimulus that Iron Mike talked about, I increasingly see that as unlikely as well, at least for the time being. The Pentagon's not going to get nearly what it wants because they're totally unified on this. And not only is Senator McConnell sort of adrift, but today he announced he's sending home members to wait and till they need to come back. So once members go and go back home, you know, that again, that adds another layer of difficulty to passing anything.
Michael, I know you're on a short time leash. Let me ask you for some takeaways from Tuesday's primary results. Obviously, Kris Kobach lost. That was a relief to the GOP in Kansas that was worried whether or not it would become the first time in eight decades that the GOP would lose a Kansas Senate seat. Justice Democrat Cori Bush, unseated incumbent William Lacey Clay in Missouri, in a district that extends into the suburbs, but also in inner city St. Louis. Walk us through the implications as you see them. And also, by the time we convene again, former Vice President Biden will have announced his running mate. And I just want to go around the horn. Who you guys think the former vice president should pick as a running mate? That is something that complements him, but does not, a teammate that complicates him, but doesn't also complicate his route to the White House, where people who would be inclined to vote for Biden will not feel a reason not to vote for Biden. So, Michael, lead us off.
Okay, sure. So, yeah, I think Tuesday was interesting. I mean, Lacey Clay losing. It's another incumbent going. I think it's the fifth Democratic incumbent to lose to a progressive challenger. So the progressives continue to make some headway. I think, you know, to some degree, it's a little overblown. There's a lot of concern. And we've talked about this on our previous podcast about the progressives pushing hard to cut defense spending. There was that vote on the floor a couple weeks ago to cut defense spending by 10%. I addressed this with a member of the Democratic leadership yesterday, who shot me down right away and assured me that when the Democrats are in charge, they will not be cutting defense across the board by 10% or even 5%. But, you know, we'll see. I think Kobach losing in Kansas was a sigh of relief for Republicans, but the Senate still is very much in play. I mean, assuming that Doug Jones is unable to win in Alabama, the Democrats would need to win four seats in the Senate, provided they win the White House with the vice president casting the tiebreaker. There are three seats that are very tough for the Republicans to hold on to: Arizona, Colorado, and North Carolina. But there are a lot of other seats in play, and the Democrats would just need to capture one of those in Maine or Montana, Georgia, Iowa, Alaska suddenly is possibly in play, and even Texas numbers are not as good as they should be. So if one of those goes, the Democrats could be in charge of the Senate. So I think whereas there was one sigh of relief for the Republicans, I think the momentum is still very much favoring the Democrats.
And about vice president, do you want to, you know, weigh in on that in any way on who you think the, you know, of the people? Then again, I mean, Joe Biden could pick somebody aside from the people that we've been talking about, right? I mean, he can pick anybody you want. Back to your point, Michael, I think it was last week where you said nobody saw Dan Quayle coming at the end of the day for George H.W. Bush. Do you see any of these candidates as being something that is more helpful to Biden than potentially hurtful?
You know, I think there's no perfect choice for him. But I also do believe, and obviously we've all heard this phrase before, nobody votes for vice president. So I think he's just got to pick the one that's going to compliment him the most and do the least amount of damage. Because whoever he picks, they're going to be looking at. No one is perfect. So they're going to harp on whatever negative things there are in this person's background. And I think it's a tough choice. I don't envy his position. No, I think he's really also narrowed his search dramatically. So he has much more of a limited pool of people to choose from than previous people in his position.
Well, right. I mean, I think what's interesting is everybody is seeing problems, right? So if it's Susan Rice, it's somebody without elected office, who's not held elected office, is seen as somebody who's highly intelligent, but an abrasive personality, who, you know, then you can do Benghazi, 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 which is negative. With Kamala Harris, it doesn't excite the base. With Karen Bass, you know, it's like she's a pro Castro or, you know, presided over a Scientology building opening. You know, Val Demings was a police chief. I mean, it's you know, there is no, you know, perfect candidate. And then, you know, Tammy Duckworth, her answer about George Washington wasn't good enough, right? I mean, it's kind of absurd. And I know, Michael, if you've got to jump, but let's, kind of move through everybody. Dov, give us your sense, and then Gordon, give us your sense on, the political ramifications of these primaries, but also where you guys think the Vice President Biden has to end up ultimately to get more votes rather than costing himself more votes, because the vice presidency doesn't count unless the guy running for president is 77 years old. And then all of a sudden it counts.
I think that what Mike said is right in general, but your last point is critical. People this time around are going to be voting not just for vice president, but for a person who could be president, not in 4 years' time, but sometime sooner than that. I think that the image that Biden has projected simply isn't as strong as, say, the image that the Speaker of the House projects, who's older than he is. Pelosi is 80, but nobody talks about anything to do with her losing half a step, whereas there's talk about Biden and there's talk about Trump. So he's got to get over that. And even if he does, people will, in the back of their minds, are going to say, okay, this vice president could well be president. And once you get into that, you start coming up with different sorts of considerations. If it's, he's already limited it to women. He hasn't committed himself to a woman of color, but, and that could be the governor of New Mexico, who's Hispanic, as well as several of the African-American candidates. But he's kind of boxed himself into that corner. So his choices are relatively limited. And I think that a major factor for him may well be, okay, who can conveys to the public the most arguable case for somebody who could take over for me, even though I don't think I'm going to be the one that has to be taken over for? I think that's a consideration that just hasn't emerged in the last, I don't know how many presidential elections.
Not any in my mindset. Gordon, do you want to weigh in?
Yes, as somebody who is probably the most senior person in this august group, I can tell
still,
you one of the things.
Still looking good, thinking good, and moving good,
still,
Gordon.
Still hanging in there, but that demonstrates
you
my
wanna,
point.
You want to be vice president, Gordon?
No, I do not, but it illustrates my point. And my point is, when you are in your 70s or in your 80s, the range of competence and capability is huge. It's huge. You're in fact... It distributes more widely because the body does tend to deteriorate and so does the brain. That's just science. So the reality is some people at 75 are incompetent and some people at 80 are wildly competent. It's not driven by their age. So I think that plus if you add the point that has already been made, which is people are going to want to look at this person as a potential president, I think perhaps more than they normally do. And that suggests to me that of all of the people that have been put forward, probably amongst that group, Kamala Harris comes the closest. Nobody's perfect here. Nobody in this group of people, women, touches every base. But then, no vice presidential candidate ever does. Harry Truman, God knows, was not considered the sharpest tool in the shed when he was made FDR's running mate. So, and then in April, he took over. So, we don't know, in fact, what people will rise to when they become president. But if competence in this election matters on the front end of the election before people vote, then the people with the most avoirdupois, the most maturity, the most clear-spokenness, and the most political experience are going to, I think, look like the ones that can help him the most.
Mackenzie, I know you're staying out of this conversation because it's nitty-gritty and political. I have a defense-related question for you in just a moment. But Gordon and Dov, do you guys carry any big lessons away from Tuesday's primaries, or are you sort of in line with where Michael was?
No, I'm pretty much in the same place that Michael was on the outcome of the primaries. It's a mistake, I think, to over-conclude from primaries. As I've said before, on the program, you are going to get progressive Democrats elected in places where progressive Democrats can be elected. You're not going to get progressive Democrats elected in places where progressive Democrats cannot get elected. It's all about the electorate. And because in the Missouri race, we add not only electoral considerations, but the longevity of the incumbent and the racism issue now abroad in the land, it seems to me almost predictable that that he was going to be in trouble and she was going to win. But I don't want to overgeneralize that to say, oh my gosh, the left's taken over the Democratic Party, the right's taken over the Republican Party. I don't think that's what you get out of a lot of these primaries.
Dove?
Well, I think that's basically right, except that I think the even though Gordon's analysis is I think on target, I think that Bush's victory simply energizes the progressive left. I mean, it is a victory that they can point to,
and will.
It's yes. In addition to the so-called squad. I mean, Tlaib won overwhelmingly in Michigan. Let's see if Omar wins in Minnesota. My guess is she will. And what that means is that it's just going to be that little bit harder for Pelosi, if she remains speaker or whoever is speaker, to keep the caucus in line. Because the progressives tend to make a lot more noise than the moderates. And that does influence people.
Let me pick up a piece of that thread, Vogel, because it's going to be interesting downstream. I was briefed the last couple of days about a recent Rethink Media polling that was done of Democrats and independents-leaning Democrats with respect to issues of foreign policy. And that can tell you, to the extent that Dove is right and that there is a progressive instinct growing at the heart of the Democratic Party, those priorities, as indicated in the polling, are especially interesting. A significant, overwhelming 85-15 preference to working together to using military strength in America's overseas relations. 77-23 working with rather than standing up to China. And particularly the question of priorities, a strong leaning towards spending for the domestic and health and education needs of the country, and this is not a polling of progressives. This is a polling of Democrats and independents-leaning Democrat. You know, there is a theme here that is likely to show up even with people who are not so progressive when a Congress emerges, particularly if the Democrats retain the House and take control of the Senate.
Mackenzie, let me bring you in on this. You've been listening very closely to the Team Biden that has been doing a pretty good job in trying to sort of express its strategic vector. Tony Blinken has been doing a great job at that. So is Jake Sullivan, as well as those who are not directly involved with the campaign have been putting very, very thoughtful pieces out. We had Michelle Flournoy and Gabrielle Sheffetz, who talked about what the acquisition model for the next administration should be. That was a terrific piece. I shall also want to commend to people to listen to the great conversation we had with Dove and Ilan Berman yesterday on Iran and Israel and China. Talk to us a little bit about some of the messages you're hearing and how you interpret them, because the administration is scouting out a pretty tough but more measured piece of terrain, it appears. How do you interpret sort of what you're hearing from the Biden campaign at this point?
So what you see are some common themes. Some overlap with the Obama administration, and some are areas that reflect and recognize a post-pandemic world, which is that tension that we've been talking about each week between safety at home and security from challenges abroad. And of course, as the Army chief said this week, you don't want your military doing policing and vice versa. And that's true. I think there's a natural complementary role for the two to exist. But I think Americans are increasingly going to question the vast sums we do spend on defense. So the talk is of more limited aims, right, and objectives with the use of force and even just the use of forward presence and putting troops forward. limited strike operations, reducing permanent force commitments, which interestingly enough, of course, is happening now in some small ways in Europe under this president. But that's the thing. See, this president has always been, relative to his own party, he's been more aligned with the Ted Cruz's and Rand Paul's, which are more aligned with many progressives than he was with the party writ large. And so there is some overlap with Trump, although many might not want to admit that. Avoiding major engagements, investing in platforms that increase offshore capabilities, right? So it's sort of the thinking of a defense-dominant world where it's not just cheaper, it just doesn't make sense to be the nation that invests in all these very exquisite and expensive and hard to move and transport offensive weaponry. So, and finally, the universal theme, investing in the Navy and the Air Force and reducing the Army significantly. This is all really the trends, lines, and themes of various articles of interest from those people that are right now informing the campaign.
And Dove Gordon, how do you sense where we are and how the picture is filling out? And then I've got two more quick questions before we wrap up for the week.
Now, I think McKenzie's on target. Look, you've got a president who wants to pull back from the world. You've got a progressive Democratic wing, which is saying exactly the same thing. The reasoning is different, but the basic approach is very much the same. And Biden, of course, is a mainstream candidate. Most of his advisors are mainstream. But again, of course, one factor will be who he chooses as vice president and how influential that woman is going to be. But beyond that, if there is a Democratic sweep of Congress as well as the White House, does that mean that maybe they don't cut the budget by 10%? But we've all agreed that the budget is probably, the defense budget is probably peaked out anyway, regardless of who the president is. Right. That might accelerate if you have a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president and a noisy left wing. So I think that whether it's Trump or it's Biden, you're going to see America pulling back. The only difference, and it's a significant difference, is that the Biden people and Biden himself are totally committed to working with allies and friends, and their definition of burden sharing is quite different. Whereas Trump, of course, doesn't want to work with anybody.
Well, I think succinct and to the point as usual, Dove. Gordon?
I think the one point that I would underline in what Dove said is that the tone, particularly with respect to the way the United States engages with alliances, is the tone is going to be very different. The consistency of policymaking and approach is going to be very different. The process by which policy options emerge will be very different, all in a Biden administration, from the chaos, confusion, and disorder that we see coming out of the Trump administration. But I do think there's going to be a stronger emphasis on the diplomatic tools, probably more money and more people, Department of State, USAID. The distribution of capabilities amongst the services, there will be a push, I think, to shrink the size of the Army and to deal particularly with the Navy. I don't know whether the 355 ship target is going to continue to be the target, because I don't think the resources will be there. And that's my last point. We clearly are headed for an era of flat defense budgets, almost irrespective of who actually wins the presidency. But if it's a Biden administration, I don't see 10% cuts. I don't see ham-handed cuts, but I do see a flat, maybe not even growing in real terms, defense budget.
I find it's laughable to me that people continue to talk about bringing U.S. soldiers home when U.S. soldiers overseas are actually underwritten by the host governments. And so the incremental cost of keeping those soldiers is actually less than bringing them home and building barracks for them and whatnot. So I always, and it's much easier to forward deploy people in Asia from bases in Asia or across Europe from bases in Germany than it is to constantly dispatch them from the United States, which I think is extremely expensive and can be very, very wasteful, especially given how it is we go about doing that. Let me ask two really quick questions before we sign off. First to you, Mackenzie, CQ Brown is now the new Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, having succeeded David Goldfein, who did a terrific job as Chief of Staff of the Air Force. Clearly a visionary who put a premium on better integration of battle management and command and control systems, something that was very important to him. And unfortunately, we haven't made as much progress on that. And General Goldfein has lamented about that. Talk to us a little bit about what Dave Goldfein's legacy is going to be and what you think some of the priorities for CQ Brown have to be.
I agree with you. He is a visionary and was a really quiet, thoughtful leader. That was what the Air Force needed at this time. You know, he had a great working relationship with his civilian counterpart. That's not been the case for every chief in the last two decades. He agreed with the former Secretary of the Air Force, Heather Wilson, and finally had defined, which may now be OBE, but still he was able to get to the definition of the Air Force, you know, size, shape, and structure that they need at 386 operational squadrons. He oversaw the standing up of this new Space Force, even if it were reluctantly or whatever, behind the scenes, he got behind his ultimate boss and agreed to do it, I think, better and thoughtfully than some in the House would have hoped it would be. Then there was also really bolstering the role of squadron commanders. You know, he wanted to give commanders greater flexibility to do their jobs. And if you talk to some, which reporters have when I was reading up on this, you know, they believe that they do have, you know, more higher risk tolerance from the people above them to take care of whatever the unique situation is that they're doing on their level, not to have to run everything up the flagpole. Obviously, a heavy focus on the Joint Strike Fighter program, moving that forward for the Air Force because they have to, taking on the F-15EX when that wasn't the Air Force's preference after it was imposed upon them, but now potentially really coming around to that. And we'll see, you know, if the next budget doesn't just make that the full-time fourth-gen program, but also dealing with the pilot shortage, right? That's been constant under his watch and his previous boss's watch. Repairing relations with Congress, which is really important, and that's only done behind the scenes, and tackling this really nerd issue that people like me care about, but really nobody else does, which is the Air Force's pass-through budget, where right. The intelligence community parks a significant amount of money in the Air Force budget, but it goes untouched by the Air Force. But the last thing I'll say is, you know, his work on the sort of the Internet of Things for the military, or whatever we're calling the Joint All-Domain Command Control plus the Advanced Battle Management System, right? That's like hard to even spit out on the podcast, much less explain to politicians. We've seen them, you know, ask Mark Zuckerberg questions about Twitter, right? I mean, so it's just the politicians, they can't grasp it. Thank you. I'm glad you got my joke. They can't grasp it. It's even hard for the chiefs to grasp it because when they were coming up through the ranks at a young age, you know, this wasn't an issue for them either. It was still a Ouija board, you know, on the carrier. So to aspire to this, two, explain it, and three, unify all of the chiefs, because while it's a core Air Force responsibility, all the services are going to have to be bought in and help pay for it. He did something that I can't think of in modern times that any other member of the Joint Chiefs was able to do. He got the entire Joint Chiefs to sign a memo to the Secretary of Defense saying that JADC2, the command and control system, was their number one priority for the 2021 budget request, and that Secretary Esper received that, and he changed things around because it was so remarkable what Goldfein had done behind the scenes.
You know, very big kudos to him, as you noted, that he has worked extremely well with, whether it was Deborah Lee James or working as he did very, very well with... Deborah Lee James. Yes, it was. Okay. 3-2-1. Working very, very well with Deborah Lee James as he did with Heather Wilson, as he has with Barbara Barrett. CQ Brown is also a highly capable, extremely thoughtful officer, obviously historic first African-American service chief who put an extremely impassioned message out to the force that still has people reflecting as one of the most powerful senior leadership messages they've ever heard go out to a force. What do you think his priorities need to be now that he's in charge and has a very full plate?
Well, I believe he needs to always keep that in mind as sort of the the role model for the Air Force and all of the services as having risen to that level. And dealing with race, helping the civilian and other chiefs think about race relations. I mean, Secretary Esper said this week he was surprised by the impact of racial injustice on mostly enlisted service members. So clearly this is an issue that's going to continue to reverberate through the force. And he will always, I think they will always, he will always be looked to provide guidance and advice. But unfortunately, the big issue is going to be, hey, we can't afford 386 operational squadrons. So how do you want to deal with that when presumably the core tenets of the National Defense Strategy live into the next administration, which is, you know, long-term competition with China, a more naval and air power centric strategy. So then what are your new solutions with the NDS at 3 years old, essentially?
The one thing I want to just point out before we go to Dove for one last word is, it is incredible what Fingers Goldfein did to get the services aboard on the JADC2 message. What I find disappointing is that cooperation will extend only as far as Navy Rear Admiral Oscar Meyer has said at the West Coast Aerospace Forum, and when you were there as well, and so were we, when Oscar Meyer said, you know, we're going to coordinate this as closely as our own individual service equities will allow. And that's always the kiss of death on any program like this. We'll coordinate them insofar as Department of Navy programs will allow, or as much as Army programs will allow. Although I think General Eric Wesley was a little bit more enthusiastic about the importance of that competition. It's not to say the Navy isn't interested in cooperation, rather, but it was kind of right. I think this is something that folks have to focus a lot more on rather than a lot less.
Agree.
Dove, very, very quickly in about 30 seconds, incredible explosion in Beirut, extraordinary loss of life. The death toll is expected to go significantly higher than I think it was 137 at the time when we started this recording, and more than 5,000 injured. Give us your sense on how this changes the political dynamic. You know, we had a really, really thoughtful conversation, as I mentioned, with you and Ilan yesterday, and we didn't quite get into Lebanon because we were so focused on China and Iran and Israel. Very briefly, how do we need to think about what happened? Because Lebanese are angry. They're angry at their government.
Well, they are angry at their government, and they're angry because the government essentially is the same crowd that's virtually been in charge since the Civil War of the 70s. There's one elephant in the room that most of the press has not talked about, and that's Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has tremendous influence over the government in Lebanon, and their behavior in Syria demonstrates more than anything else that they're much more attuned to what Iran wants than to what Lebanon wants. And of course, it's well known now that even the Israelis offered humanitarian assistance to Lebanon. By the way, they're very good at that. They do that around the world. And of course, the Lebanese government, being the Lebanese government, said thanks, but no thanks. Actually, they didn't even say thanks. And so the real question becomes, will we see a real change in the nature of the government of a country that has 18 religions and sects and ethnic groups and what have you, all somehow represented, that basically is run by a small group of leaders that have been around forever, them and their children, and of course their parents and grandparents. If this continues, I don't know where Lebanon goes. It's deeply in debt. Its sources of revenue have just blown up with this explosion. And it creates all kinds of problems. The only good fortune, I guess, that these miserable folks have right now is that Syria is so preoccupied with its own civil war that it's not going to do what it did some time back and occupy the country. But leaving that aside, this is a very, very troubled country, and it's not clear who's going to save them.
And unfortunately, the wealthy Gulf nations that have historically been its benefactors are also finding themselves in an oil price driven price crunch. Very briefly, Mackenzie points out the first U.S. Air Force C-17 has arrived in Beirut with supplies and relief for the Lebanese people. So that's certainly good news. Gordon, any last thoughts? And Dove, any last thoughts on CQ Brown or Fingers Goldfein? Going once, well, going twice?
Nope.
Since I still got the floor, and then Gordon can have the last word. One of the things about Goldfein is that he was the first to sit, and he sat down with the chief master sergeant to talk about the racial issue at it right after the Lafayette Square business. And let's not minimize that. Goldfein was very sensitive to some of the issues that the Air Force had with women, with minorities. And I think that's part of the legacy. And of course, Brown will carry that forward. But it is an indication that it may not just be Brown, General Brown, that pushes these issues. I think all the chiefs right now are very sensitive to the fact. Look at the Army. The Army's got what, 14 or 16% African Americans and a double-digit percentage of Latino Americans. The services have to be on top of this, and my impression is that chiefs are.
Mackenzie, you have a last word. You have some breaking news coming out of the American Enterprise Institute. What is it?
I do, but I don't know whose spot she's going to bump on the roundtable, me or Dr. Zackheim, since we just picked up former Comptroller Elaine McCusker from DOD. She's going to join our team in September, and she's going to work on defense strategies, innovation, et cetera, all kinds of stuff we talk about every week.
That's absolutely terrific. We welcome her aboard, and we would look forward to welcoming her on the podcast at some point as well. And
let me say something about Elaine McCusker. Elaine McCusker is terrific. And when she was planning to leave, we were in touch, and I think it's a tremendous addition to AEI. With Mackenzie and a bunch of other folks there, it's a strong team, and she's going to make it stronger.
Absolutely. We wish General Goldfein the very best. There are some of us who think he would have made a terrific chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but alas, it's a choice that's made by the president and something that Mark Milley is working hard and doing a great job on as well. Everybody, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it and look forward to having you guys back on. You're always welcome. Thanks again.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.